right.
Hello. This talk will be done by Gordon Savicic, an artist, critical engineer, with an impressive track record of worldwide expositions, and Felix Stalder, professor of the Zurich University of the Arts. They will talk about artistic research in the study and visualization of the rewilding of a migratory bird, from assisted migration to social, technological, information, and ecological aspects. Thank you. Give it up for them.
Thank you for the introduction and good morning. Thank you for coming out so early. My name is Felix Stalder.
Yeah, hi everyone, my name is Gordon Savicic.
And we are part of an artistic research project called Latent Spaces at the Zurich University of the Arts. And the larger context, the framework is that we investigate the ambiguity of data that is always present despite the data's numerical precision. And as the data scientists in the room will know, ambiguity is usually regarded as a bad thing. There are lots of techniques of curve smoothing and cutting out the outliers that are used to get rid of ambiguity and get unambiguous result. But we actually see ambiguity as something positive because it opens up about the space for discussion on different meanings that we want to imbue and the consequences of these meanings for our dealing with the data and the world mediated by it. We started by looking into the publicly available data of wild animals and the technologies that are used in these projects. We are interested in how they transform our notion of what a wild animal is, and also what we can learn about the role of technology in supporting rather than destroying natures. As a disclaimer, we are not biologists. We are not responsible for the rewilding project per se, but we are working quite closely with biologists as artists and media researchers. One of the heavily datafied animals is the northern bald ibis Waldrapp in German. It's about 1.4 kilogram bird, so it's a fairly large bird, 1.3 meters wingspan, and it can grow up to 30 years old. It's a migratory bird. It has a natural migration in the summer. It spends its time in the northern slopes of the Alps, so in southern Germany, Switzerland, and Austria. And the winter, it usually spends in the warmer regions of the Mediterranean. What you see here is a drawing from 1555, and for centuries this was the only drawing of this bird that existed because the bird went extinct in Europe in 1621. In 1977, it was put on the critically endangered list globally because there were only about 700 birds left. And there has been a rewilding project in Europe that started in 2013 by the biologist Johannes Fritz. It's an attempt to reverse a local extinction, so birds were imported and raised in zoos. And the rewilding now is not simply opening the door of the cage, so to speak, and releasing the animals, but actually creating conditions for the bird to become wild again in a region where it hasn't been wild for, you know, roughly 400 years. So what does it take to make an animal wild again? Well, there's technology on the bird itself, and we will talk about this in more detail in a minute, but we discovered that the technology on the bird is actually only a small part of a vast, more than human infrastructure on which this bird is becoming wild again. And to map this vast infrastructure, we created a map together with the artist Vladan Jola last year. And I'll quickly run through the map and we'll zoom into it throughout the talk. At the center of the map, there are four quadrants on the top right. There are the technological elements of this infrastructures on the top left. There are the social elements of the infrastructure, kind of the, how the public is involved. On the bottom left, there are the ecological elements, the kind of the discontiguous areas in which the bird lives. And on the bottom right are kind of the scientific institutional elements of the that produce and create meaning and finance this infrastructure. And while the center of the map shows the relationships between the different elements, there are also three scales. On the top, there's a spatial scale that starts from the planetary dimensions of thousands of kilometers and zooms into the millimeter scale through steps of 100. It juxtaposes the elements and the data that you already see in the diagram a second time, but in new relation in terms of spatial scales. On the left, there is a monetary scales because we live in a world in which everything has a price, but not all of these values actually make sense, but our society, our system needs monetary values for everything. So for example, they need to quantify in monetary terms the value of a dead bird, which of course is hard to do, and there are different ways of doing it, coming up with wildly different figures, but you need to put a figure on a dead bird. On the bottom, there's the time scale, the temporal axis, and it's separated into three different categories. There's a geological time that starts with the genetic age of the bird, which is about 1 million years old, much older than humans, and goes down to a biological age of kind of lived time, and through what we called atomic time scales, down to the nanosecond of the GPS that allow us to observe the rhythms and events that are related in this project. And all of these different scales, the time scales, they need to work together for this project to stabilize. The rewilding, as I already mentioned, started in 2013 after about 11 years of preparation, feasibility studies, and raising funds. And it will end according to plans, but very few things go according to plan, in 2028. With the goal of creating a fully self-sustainable population. And that means it needs at least 357 rewilded birds for the population to be safe against catastrophic events, enough genetic diversity, and so on. After that, this infrastructure will be downscaled, but it's unlikely that it will ever fully disappear. And we'll come back to that point of, what does it mean for nature to be left to itself throughout the talk. Because we get this often this question quite often, why can't we leave nature simply alone? Isn't nature best left alone? And we already heard about this yesterday in respect to climate engineering. There are two main reasons why we can't leave nature alone. I mean, the most obvious is because we don't. We interfere massively in nature, and one of the effects of that we are currently in the sixth great extinction. The rate of extinction is about 1,000 to 10,000 times that of the normal rate of extinction, so we are massively intervening. And so the question is not really can we leave it alone, because we don't, but the question is can we repair at least some of the damage that we are doing? And there's the second reason why we can't leave nature alone, and this obviously is climate change. Nothing is left alone from climate change. The climate zones move north about 400 meters a year, and this is 1.2 2-5 meters every day. So for a plant to stay in the same climate zone and be left alone, it would have to move 1.5 meters every day, which obviously is a hard thing to do. And we'll see later that, you know, climate change already affects these projects quite dramatically. So there's simply no nature, no pre-human baseline to which we can return when we leave nature alone. So for the better or worse, mostly for the worse, but maybe also for the better, we have to intervene in some way. I hand over to Gordon.
I'm going to talk about some of the technological elements we discovered also in our research. And well, one of the reasons why we can't only the cage, as Felix mentioned, for rewilding is the challenge of migration for this specific bird. So the birds, they have a natural tendency towards migration, but the routes and the destination, they are actually socially learned from their parents. But since the rewilded young birds actually have no elders to learn from, it's basically the humans to take on this role and of teaching this migratory route. And they're doing this with this ultralight airplane, which is an extremely complex task, also needs lots of logistics. But it also actually gives the advantage that they are able to find a suitable habitat for the winter region in Europe, like Central Europe, which is a very densely populated and agricultured area. But also there is a very intensive phase of bonding. So there are two foster mothers who spend actually 3 to 4 months in very close contact to the birds, and they feed them and care for them. And this creates a mutual bonding and adaptation. And also the foster mothers actually, they get to know them very, very well, the birds. They can actually identify them very individually, but just like looking at them. And one very important thing to remember is also the birds, they don't follow the airplane by nature. It's they follow the people, like they follow those two foster mothers on their migration. And after the migration, this bonding process is actually extremely, like, is reversed, and the birds are released. When they are released, they get fitted a tracking device, which is like a GPS tracker, and, well, it's not easy to mount, so they are wearing a little harness. The weight of the tracker is about 1 to 2% of the entire bird's weight, which is well in the regions of what is supposedly, like in scientific terms, acceptable mass that the bird can carry. But actually what they found out is that the aerodynamics are heavily impacted by wearing such a device on its back. And so how do you optimize aerodynamics? Well, you actually test it in a wind channel. And so they actually started to build a wind channel in order to find the balance between like a functional tracker, a device that is big enough to have a battery and everything, but also has the least minimal aerodynamical impact. So there is an optimization going on, and some birds were actually specifically trained to fly in this wind channel that was set to 45 kilometers an hour. As a fun fact, this was built in a former dairy barn, and it's actually cohabitated by a domesticated wild pig on the right side. Also, in the entire wind channel design is actually open source, so there was a paper being published last year. If everyone is interested, for 25K approximately material costs, you can build your own wind channel in order to do some aerodynamic testing, which is quite an interesting thing to do. Focusing back on the tracker itself, on the tracking device, this is in this specific project, they use a device that's called OrniTrack 20, 20 indicating the weight of the device for 20 grams. This contains a GPS receiver, a data upload via the GSM or the 4G network, a solar charging module and a tiny battery, and an accelerometer and a magnetometer. There's no external antenna, which also sometimes causes actually problems in terms of aerodynamics. And an interesting thing also that the tracker is actually has to be built for very extreme conditions in terms of water, heat of direct sun exposure, rough or cold weather in the mountains, and actually the birds are much more robust than the tracking device itself, which is also hilarious. Looking at the data flow, so first the tracking device uploads actually its GPS position via a 2G network or newer ones via 4G network to the manufacturer, which is a server based in Lithuania called the Ornitella. But also from there on, the data is being synced to MoveBank, which is a pre-existing data repository for animal location data maintained by the Max Planck Institute. In MoveBank, you have roughly 8,000 studies that are being collected within this repository, and there are roughly like 4.8 billion data points, location points, and about 800 peer-reviewed papers actually came out of this repository. Just to give you an idea also about the importance of this, the Northern Bald IBIS project, it has about roughly 13 million data points, and about 80% of the animals of the rewilding project are wearing a tracker. And what interested us is basically, well, MoveBank provides a web interface for two public studies. This is addressed towards a scientific community, but there is also a representation for more for the general public, which is like expressed through this app. It's available for Android and iOS. This is called Animal Tracker App, which provides almost real-time observation of animal movements. So we discovered this app also, and we wanted to get an idea of the activity on this app. We wanted to analyze this, and obviously the user interface is a bit tiresome to interact with. So we were looking for a programmatic approach to receive the data from the app. And we started a kind of a man-in-the-middle proxy, an interactive HTTPS proxy, and an old emulator running Android, an old Android version. So we could intercept the network traffic and get, actually we found an API, which was expected, but we actually found also some API endpoints where we could actually then scrape the entire database of all animals available in this animal tracker app. We could have also just asked, but this was more fun to do. And we discovered the endpoints also to HTML pages on the backend of the app, which are being used to show like sighting reports. So people can upload a sighting report of an animal if they actually see that animal in the wild. And we did another round of scraping. And then we discovered that actually the most tracked animal within the Animal Tracker app is indeed the Waldrop, followed by the white stork, who has roughly half of the sightings, and the spooner. So they're all somehow birds that are relatively large animals. Just to give you some numbers also, like there are roughly 7,300 animals within this Animal Tracker app, and we discovered that roughly 10% of these animals have a recent timestamp, so they had an update within the last 24 hours with a new location. So what we found interesting is it's not just about like tracking the animal, but also the engagement this produces. So this is a part of a larger process to create space for this animal in public awareness. So as I said, like through the scraping, we found out that there were more than 1,200 postings with images, and the Bald IBIS had most of them. And so some are really this kind of professional camera shots with a huge telephoto lens where you capture the perfect moment of a birder. And some are showing also that there are troubles transferring sometimes the image to the smartphone. So there are screen photos of the screens. Also, sometimes you see this through binoculars, so it's more like the traditional bird aesthetic, as we call it. Some are selfies. And sometimes they are just screenshots from the phone, or even like photos of newspaper articles. So it's like a second inception sighting somehow. This looks, well, a bit messy, but this is also a good thing, as we discovered, because it allows people to participate with what they already have in ways that works for them. So it's not about learning the proper technology of making a perfect birder shot, but we can just, you know, participate in this platform very, very openly. Sometimes it also creates some weird kind of glitches, as this example shows. A people triggered a false alarm of a bird that needs urgently help, because it says here, it's in German, but it says basically that this bird doesn't move since a day because it's stuck in this black container, and it just like didn't get a GPS update, and people actually taking this GPS position way too literal, because obviously there is like a plus minus 10 meters offset. And yeah, I think talking about the GPS position, maybe you want to
take over. So what is being done other than feeding conspiracy theories with this data? And the standard way of using this location data is to plot it on a map. And what we've done here is we took out one bird, Enea, with the ID ring 233, and took all the measurements from 1 year, 2021, in which the bird has flown about 6,600 kilometers and created 16,000 data points. This looks like Latin America, but it's actually the top is the region around Lake Constance, and the bottom is Tuscany. So with this, we can kind of watch the bird as it moves through kind of a natural landscape. And this is also what the Animal Tracker app allows us to do, to see the bird moving. But there's actually, it's a two-way process. It's not only that we are watching the bird, it's also that the bird is watching the infrastructure through which it moves. Because Enea, the bird we just saw, suddenly disappeared from the app. And why? Because it was in Switzerland, and Switzerland turned off the GMS network at the beginning of this year. So they had a relatively old bird with an old tracker that was relying on G2G connectivity, and you know that was deemed to be outdated, so it was turned off. But it wasn't turned off entirely, but sporadically, for probably some very local reasons, somebody have an important application, maybe for agriculture, there was occasional antennas were left on. So what you could see is actually the bird mapping these antennas that were still ongoing. There was of no use in terms of a biological or other observation of the bird, because it was too intermittent and too random in terms of where these are. But suddenly you could see a kind of a decaying infrastructure through that through the bird. So the bird was mapping the infrastructure for us. But let's zoom out a little bit and move away from this one particular case and ask ourselves, what can we learn a bit more generally about the role of technology as a support mechanism for a planet on the brink of breakdown? Well, the first thing we learned is that technology is not the solution. Technology plays an important role, but it's still a small role, because there are many more important actors in these large-scale, highly independent network. And important is not so much a technology in and of itself, but really how it transforms these actors and how it binds them together in these networks. And to capture that, we need perhaps another narrative, an antidote to the big tech narrative of saving nature through some, complicated new technology. And we could call this perhaps a mundane technology, technology that's part of the everyday, that is socially smart rather than technologically or artificially intelligent.
Yeah, so we identified this kind of mundane tech, and what are the characteristics of this? As Felix outlined, it's not about maybe cutting edge, not the latest and greatest. As we've seen also, this GPS tracker is a pretty basic device. Also, frugality is something important. Don't think what the tech could do, but what you really have to do. And obviously a long-term aspect. So long-term is more important than state-of-the-art. Why? Because you have minimal upgradability. So once you deploy the tracker on the animal, it's very hard to catch the animal back and to put in some updates or like to upgrade the hardware. But there's also an important aspect of like a long-term cost factor. It's off-the-shelf stuff and easy to use, but still the tracker costs about like 1,000 euros. It's a one-time fee, but you have an ongoing data plan, which involves several euros per month, which can add up if you're tracking like 170 or 200 birds. This can add up also depending on where the bird flies. So if it flies into a very expensive roaming region, you know, factors can add up. But also stability and reliability can be actually affected from outside the project, as we've seen with the switch off of the 2G network. So this is also like you're like embedded within larger techno environment. The case for 2G showed exactly this dependency on a long-term endeavor. Speaking on long-term, one of the bedrock tech that this project also, and one of the traditional techniques maybe to track birds is the Ring ID. It's a technology about 130 years old. Is the most long-term, the least invasive, and has almost no maintenance costs or no maintenance costs. It's also tech that has been enhanced digitally in the past, because now this number is an additional information on the ring itself, but also it refers now to an online database ID that enables informational reference about the bird history and stuff like this. But also people identify birds actually more easily, because if we are taking really high-res photos now, they can actually really read the ring ID on these images when they heavily zoom in. Well, the elephant in the room is, well, this is surveillance tech, right? And it's easy to imagine how to abuse this. And I think the particular difference here lies in the projects, in the objectives of the project, and the more than human relationships this creates. The tracking of these animals, it allows to see them also as individuals, and you can relate to them. So it creates an affect and empathy for the people who are like following them. Also, two things to note on this picture. This, again, is one of these birds is Enea, who put his nest on a windowsill this year at the Harley-Davidson Center near the Zurich airport. And also they put up a webcam after they discovered this nest, and it's very private sensitive by pixelating actually the public street, but also then just don't look at the window reflection. Also, when it's too much, actually trackers are being switched off sometimes, as this quote shows, hashtag animal stalking. So it's also not about having like a completely autonomous fleet of birds that are being tracked, but it's actually really a constant maintenance and care is necessary through so-called bird managers. Also, it's the GPS locations, as we discovered, it's not only about surveillance or like tracking them and the GPS location. Actually, this graph shows the departure date for the autumn migration of the birds, which you can read through, and through some statistical processes, you can set when actually the date for the autumn migration started. And this has been shifted like only in the last 10 years. By 1 month later. So the most likely reason is, climate change. Because the birds don't have the necessary thermal winds to pass the Alps, which meant actually for this project that they had to change the migration route. They are not flying anymore over the Alps, but to the south of Spain.
Yeah, and when we focus on kind of a mundane technology, it makes it also easier to see that technology and nature are actually a continuous. We heard about this already yesterday again in the talk about climate engineering. There's no deep separation between technology and nature. And obviously, technology is made out of natural materials. We know this is a very destructive and extractive process. It has a mostly negative impact on nature, but also in times of crisis, there is a need for that. What we see on the picture are the biologists cleaning the nests of the wild birds, mostly from plastics that are picked up from the area, which is, if you go and look at the area, it's actually a very beautiful and clean area, but still full of plastic that's damaging to the birds. So we can't simply leave it alone in the age of climate change and rapid transformation of ecosystems. We are in this larger planetary context, and we need to think and act locally and globally. And all the more is this aspect of care technology, which again, you know, stresses the long-term aspects rather than the one-term fix. Mundane technology also helps us to perhaps get rid over this idea that technology is about control. And this idea really lies at the heart of our cybernetic world, put there by Norbert Wiener right at the beginning when he claimed that technology, that cybernetics is about control and communication in the animal and machine. And this idea of control, of using technology to control nature, to control each other, created all kinds of problems that we heard yesterday and will hear in the coming days. And not the least, it creates this fantasy of omnipotence, of complete control and mastery. We have to move, actually, we think, in an opposite direction. We have to embrace the limits of control and the limits of knowability. Certain things we simply don't know, so we should treat them with respect and humility. So we need to increase the autonomy of humans and non-humans, but never, not in the sense of complete, you know, leave them alone, everybody can do whatever they want. This is not a useful way of autonomy, but increase the degrees of freedom to choose how to relate and to relate to whom. And we need to build into these systems the conditions for happy surprises. We should see a surprise as something positive rather than something that, you know, speaks to a breakdown of control. So in such a project, and the technology it uses, it's really not about scaling up. It's not about reaching global scales, but to create the right conditions for scaling down. To finish, some references on the website that you see below. You can see the map and also get some tours, audio tours through the map. But obviously, you can also, and we highly recommend, to check out the biologists, the project directly. We also have a few printouts of the map. There's a PDF on the website that you can download, but you also have a few printouts here. Obviously, we forgot them in the hotel, but we'll bring them tomorrow. So if you catch us tomorrow, we can get you a print. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, while people line up. Oh, no. Yeah. While people line up, I actually have a question, and it's about. If you can show back the image of the parents or the mothers like transporting the birds around, mm-hmm. Did they really fly like all the way from essentially Italy all the way up to, I don't know, it was at least the height of Innsbruck or Munich?
They fly down?
Yeah, they had to fly in that thing for how many kilometers?
Initially, they have to only fly down.
Oh, okay.
Because once they're there, they remember where they come from, and the next year they remember where they go to. It's only one time. But in the initial routes, it was about 800 kilometers. And in the new route, they have to take around the Alps because they can no longer go over the Alps because they leave too late. It's 2,300 kilometers. So it takes them about a month or 6 weeks.
Okay.
The birds alone would be much faster. Yeah. But the light plane is slow. So they have to teach the birds how to fly slowly.
Nice.
Also, technically speaking, it's like the destination of the south migration is burned like an Abram, so it stays in their memory forever. Wow. They also can find the way back where they were breeding without any assistance.
Nice. Well, question one.
Yeah, thank you for your very interesting talk. I have a question. So what comes to my mind first is the technology route, which you did not encourage to follow. So to make it simpler, to make it cheaper, use an AirTag, for instance, to track those birds. But what is actually your recommendation as a technique to use? I mean, my takeaway was we shouldn't leave them alone. So should we observe them, use the app, make a photo, and so track the birds non-invasively in order to follow them?
Mm. Mm-hmm. I think there are different levels of tracking involved. One is the biologists that are very closely work with the birds and care for the birds and support them and, you know, teach them and all of that. And they learn a lot through the tracking. And the other part is that that we need in our imagination, public imagination, places for wild animals. And most of us living in cities and highly cultured areas, we never encounter wild animals. And if we encounter them, they're anonymous. So this allows this form of tracking, but also of sighting, of allows to create other narratives and other ways of relating to the bird. That's neither a pet that's fully controlled, but it's also not an anonymous animal. But it's an animal with its own characteristics. You know, this is that age, last year, it, you know, had this dramatic accident or whatever, or two kids, and you get to sense that this is a full being rather than just, you know, some random thing walking by.
Hi. Did you ever think about building your own tracking device, GPS tracking device, and make it open source like the wind tunnel?
Actually, no. We haven't thought about building our device, just actually lack of time maybe. But actually we asked the manufacturer if they would release the designs open source, but there was a clear no for them. Even though they're like also, I mean, their background is like they're ornithologists and also scientists, but for some reason they were not so interested in releasing their schematics.
Well, one from the Signal Angel.
Well, there are currently two questions from the net. First question is by Paul Furzer, who is wondering whether the sound of the paramotor engine was a problem when training the birds.
Yeah, that is a huge problem. That's why they're also having like this kind of training with the birds. What they're doing with the young birds, they kind of get them used to the airplane. So they make like little flights around the breeding grounds before undertaking the long migration route.
And the second current question by Jairo, he's wondering, or they are wondering, whether the drought in Spain is affecting the current migratory routes.
At the moment, it doesn't, because they don't really spend too much time, you know, eating and picking worms while they are migrating. And at the destination in Andalusia, there's actually another kind of rewilding project that you know, does some basic care and maintenance. But at the moment, this seems not to be a problem. The main problem really is that when they move, when they take off too late from Northern Europe, the winds over the Alps are no longer sustainable for them to, you know, to rise with the thermal winds. That's the main problem at the moment.
Thanks for a really interesting project. I wanted to ask about the people because it sounds like a very diverse project with people from many different disciplines working together for tech that is, as you said, socially smart. So I was wondering if you had examples or experiences of how you brought these people together and what worked well for this very multidisciplinary project.
If you make it short, you have an
idea. Yeah. Actually, since we are mostly observing the network rather than building it, we're not the biologists, I can't really say anything specific to that.
Okay, the last one on mic four.
Hi, I just wanted to ask if it's possible to recover the tracking devices after a few years, or if that is not feasible.
It's actually difficult to recover them. I mean, on the live birds, when they, you know, die, then it's easier. But simply because the longer the birds are out there, the more stressful it becomes to catch them again. Even though we said they were reversing the bonding process, it's never fully reversed. The foster mothers recognize the birds, and the birds also, a few years later, still recognize the people. But catching them is really, really stressful, and they want to avoid that as much as possible. So no, it's not really possible. Thank you. They sometimes fly around with broken trackers. They no longer send anything.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.